Welcome. This is our subscriber interview with Joseph P. Farrell. His new book is The Cosmic War, Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics and Ancient Texts. And we are continuing our fascinating discussion. And I want to begin this segment to talk about Apsu and Tiamat. And I want to read a passage from the Enuma Elis. This is the Babylonian or Mesopotamian creation epic. When on high heaven was not named, and the earth beneath did not yet bear a name, and the primeval Apsu who begat them, and Chaos, Tiamat, the mother of them both, their waters were mingled together, and no field was formed, no marsh was to be seen, when of the gods none had been called into being. The epic names, three primeval gods, Apsu, the fresh water, Tiamat, the salt water, and their son, Mummy, I think that it's called, apparently the mist. And this interpretation of it, of course, I actually got this passage from Wikipedia. But when I read about this, and especially about the mingling of the water, I interpret that a little bit like this, actually, is about the collision or destruction of planets, and the fact that we now here on Earth both have salt water and fresh water, and that in itself actually is an interesting study. What's your interpretation of that passage I read there?
I interpret it at great length. In fact, I'm glad you brought up the Enuma Elish, because I cite from that particular text extensively in the Giza Death Star Destroyed, and I reproduce that citation in The Cosmic War, because in my reading of it, I interpret most of those texts as a metaphor or an attempt to preserve a physics of an undifferentiated medium. And the reason I do so is really because a physicist in this country by the name of Paul LaViolette, who's written extensively about these types of things in his works, the undifferentiated medium, water often becomes, if we read these texts, particularly from Sumeria and Egypt very carefully, becomes a metaphor for what they understand as basically a kind of an ether or a fabric of space-time, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I do in the Giza Death Star Destroyed and again in the Cosmic War is I cite the subsequent passages where Marduk and Tiamat are actually at war. And it's very interesting because I think that if we view the Enuma Elish in that way, most of the text is, in fact, about that war. It's not about the initial process of differentiation in creation. It's kind of a backdrop, that particular passage that you read, is kind of a backdrop for this very lengthy description of the war and the weapons that were used on each side and what subsequently happened in the destruction of Tiamat.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I interpret the entire text as less a creation epic and more as a war epic, which really kind of puts me at odds with most of academia, because they, of course, understand it to be entirely a creation epic, and that the war is simply a metaphor for that process.
Yeah.
But I take it very literally, because if we look at the passages that follow this, particularly in the fourth tablet of the Enuma Elish, there are in fact seven tablets to the story, and that's why many people think that it's a creation epic, because of course it parallels 7 days of creation in the book of Genesis.
Yeah.
But if we look at the war passages themselves, what is very interesting, if you examine the passages of Marduk and his assault on Tiamat, what is described there, I think, is the mechanism, the perfect mechanism, that a kind of a weaponry that would be based on the ability to configure stresses in the medium itself would do to a planet of that size.
Mm-hmm.
Because Tiamat is described as having quaked to her very being. Marduk is described as bringing in the winds from the four corners of the compass, and so on and so forth, and then at the last moment driving his arrow into her. So it's almost kind of as if we can think of the simple analogy of filling a balloon to maximum pressure and then suddenly bursting it, you know, with a pin or something like that. It's uncannily similar to the processes of a kind of a scalar physics or a torsion-based physics that would be able to configure these things, stresses in the medium, as a weapon. And that really is the mechanism, I think, that was used or employed in this technology that I've been talking about in the previous hour.
Oh, okay. You mentioned scalar weapons.
Right.
Superheating the ionosphere, creating earthquakes. My mind is drawn back to, you know, HARP technology, basically.
Yes, yes. This is, to my mind, in examining the Giza Death Star hypothesis, and then again the Tablets of Destinies. And again, I have a whole chapter in the Cosmic War where I go through the text very carefully and speculate on the basis of certain technologies and theories in modern physics. And what I come down to is that it would appear that the Tablets of Destinies were, how to put it, they were the grating or interference pattern for a phase conjugate mirror of tremendous sophistication. Now, for your listeners who don't know what a phase conjugate mirror is, if we take a laser beam and shoot it at a target through the atmosphere of the Earth, of course the atmosphere functions as a medium, but it also distorts any reflection of that beam back to its point of origin. So scientists have learned that if they interfere two laser beams on a target and then in a optical cavity back at the source of their emission, combine that interference pattern. If they then shoot a laser beam through that interference pattern itself, it arrives at the target undistorted. That's a phase conjugate mirror.
This is similar to how holographics are.
Yes, exactly so. Exactly. The Tablets of Destinies, I believe, were a catalog of the interference pattern of various celestial bodies in the universe that were important to this civilization. And that, of course, means that they would have enabled communication with those celestial bodies as well as a weaponry able to target them. And I go a little bit further in my speculations than mere electromagnetic energy by proposing the idea that if they were gratings of the actual interference pattern created by those celestial bodies in the fabric of space-time itself, and if we were able to use longitudinal pressure waves of stress in the medium itself, reflected back through gratings of that nature, then you would have an extraordinarily powerful, very sophisticated weapon. And this I think, is more or less what the Tablets of Destinies appear to be.
This is you know, absolutely fascinating. Could this be about, how should I put it, opening time or space? Could this lead to time travel? Is this about a stargate in some way?
Any time that we're talking about stresses in the fabric of space-time itself, we are doing two things. We're talking about the ability to manipulate gravity, and we're talking about the ability to manipulate time. So as a consequence of this, as an inevitable consequence of this, you would have the ability, at least hypothetically, for some sort of manipulation of time, or if you prefer, time travel. It's this physics that I think that the Nazis were working with their Bell Project. It's the same sort of physics that, again and again, you refer to stargates and the ability of the gods to apparently to enter or leave these things. So again, it's all part of the same type of physics thinking, and it emerges very clearly from some of the tensor expressions of Einstein's 28 unified field theory, which is kind of kind of another aspect of the story that doesn't get talked about. But I have a new book at the printer right now where I go into that aspect of the physics of things.
Okay. Huh.
You're quite correct in seeing it that way, and again, I want to stress that this is a very flexible physics, because it does permit you, by this manipulation of time, to do two things. It permits you to communicate over extraordinary distances, which you're going to need if you have an interplanetary civilization of this nature. And it also enables you, therefore, not only to manipulate time, but to manipulate space-time in such a way that you can configure a weapon that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match.
Exactly. Jeez, my God. And, you know, I was just handed a question here by Frederick, or a point, rather. Basically, the points out that if we even... Because what you described here with the interference patterns with the lasers and so forth, them coming together at one point... Frederick just reminded me that, you know, how does it look when the Death Star in Star Wars fires its weapon, you know?
Exactly, exactly. And it's interesting that he points this out, because I do the very same thing, as a matter of fact, in the second Giza Death Star book, The Giza Death Star Deployed. I start out with an examination of the Star Wars movie. And it's very interesting that, as he points out, that George Lucas, somebody in his production staff, hit upon the idea of doing that in the film. And that all just kind of indicates to me that there may be more in play in the film than meets the eye.
Yeah, definitely. Again, we know that a lot of, you know, talented film directors out there, they are interested in ancient mythology and study these. And, you know, again, who knows what what sources they have and what story they might want to retell, you know?
Right, exactly so. Exactly so. And I think in the case of the Star Wars mythology, you know, it's very interesting to look at the parallels, as you say, between the film and these ancient texts, because in the film you have a terribly wicked emperor whose galactic hegemony is based upon this technological wonder weapon that he has, and that he actually uses to blow up a planet. Well, if we look at the Sumerian text, what do we have? We have gods in possession of a technology that confers... In the texts themselves state this very clearly, that confer upon them, quote, all the power of the universe, unquote. And, you know, wars are fought, planets are blown up, and it's rather odd when you stop and think about it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, if you would do a kind of a correlation to, let's take Darth Vader, who would this guy be? Enlil Enki or Marduk or...
That's a really profound question, and you're asking me to speculate off the top of my head, but I think we can do that, because Anakin Skywalker, who becomes Darth Vader, is, to my mind, a very rough assonance on the Anunnaki.
Yeah, exactly, yep.
And... you know, the fact that he turns to evil, this is something that I noticed and I talk about in The Cosmic War, because it seems that whoever possesses these tablets of destiny, they become sort of like the character Gollum in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, because these tablets of destiny appear to corrupt whoever has them at the time. Tiamat, you know, turns to this horribly destructive course. Then later on, Anzu turns to it. And then when Ninurta recovers them, he decides he's going to keep them, you know. So, you know, I think that we can probably say that Darth Vader, the best candidate in terms of the ancient Sumerian gods, would have to be one of two people, Enki, as you suggested, who's kind of a mischievous troublemaker. Or the character, or the Babylonian god Nergal, who is the god of Mars, war, and rebellion.
Yeah.
And incidentally, also the god of the underworld, who by the very nature of the case, turns against the rest of the pantheon. So, you know, again, the parallels to the movie and some of these ancient myths, as you pointed out, are just kind of amazing. And to my mind, I don't think you'd get an insurance company be willing to draw up actuarial tables to take a bet on, you know, what the probability is for all these parallels existing by coincidence.
Jeez, exactly. Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. Again, that you can look at those, and even those scenes, you know, in the when you can see Luke Skywalker, and actually, you know, when he stands looking out the desert, and you can see two suns. Again,
right.
This idea of some have said that this, you know, the potential that the planet that exploded was as bright as the sun. Michael Tesserano talked about this, and others also, of course. Or even the fact that we, you know, used to live in a binary solar system or something like that, but you know, this is a lost star or a dark star basically at this point. And again, I guess this even connects with Sitchin's work about the 10th planet. This is something that comes and goes. I mean, again, there's so many connections here.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned the double star in the movie, because this planet, it is entirely true that if this planet was of the same mass as Saturn, if it was a solid planet, then it would have been a very, very bright celestial body in the sky. So again, the correlations, the parallels, and so on, they're really rather amazing.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about these the gods and potentially who they might be. We're handed fairly, as far as I know at least, fairly few names. When I look at it, I kind of see it as this is a fairly small group of people or you know, beings or whatever we want to call them, gods, you know, in quotations. Could this be kind of a small group, kind of a renegade, you know, aliens, outlaws maybe from their own planet, or some have suggested that they've been chased throughout, you know, the universe or throughout different solar system and ended up at this place? Any ideas on that?
Excellent question. I don't discount the idea that they may have been chased throughout the universe for a very important reason, and readers of The Cosmic War will see what those reasons are in the fifth chapter of the book. This physicist I mentioned earlier, Paul LaViolette, has proposed the idea that the arrangement of pulsars in the galaxy is not accidental. And he even goes so far as to propose that they may have functioned as some form of communications grid using entire stars, in other words, to do this. Again, that would point to a very sophisticated civilization with an enormous extent in local space. If we couple that idea to that of Iapetus, Hoagland's idea that it's an artificial body, then yes, we're dealing with something very similar.
Mm-hmm.
As to the number of these people, I tend to agree with you that this appears to be a very small, comparatively speaking, small group of people or gods or whatever you wish to call them. But there is another possibility that I should mention that I think deserves a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
That is that we might be dealing, when we are referring to the names of these gods, really to a kind of a titular usage, like the Prince of Wales would be a titular usage. In other words, the name Tiamat may simply indicate the ruler or dynasty in charge of that particular planet. The name Nergal may mean the ruler or dynasty in charge of Mars, and so on and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So we might be talking about the names of houses rather than individuals. And I think if we put it in that perspective, then we might be dealing with a slightly larger group of people. One that would make a little more sense in terms of this kind of cosmic war and its ongoing, almost family feudal nature. But, yeah, either way one slices it, I think we're dealing with people at the top of the pyramid, so to speak, and therefore a very, very limited number.
Yeah. The other things that Hoagland has brought forth, like the face on Mars and even the pyramids, mm-hmm. Do you think that they actually are there and that this is evidence for previous civilizations at that planet?
Yes, I do. I believe they're real. I believe that they are indicators of a civilization. And I should mention that Mr. Hoagland, I've been in contact with him in the last month and kind of swapping ideas back and forth. Mm-hmm. He has recently come out with a new book called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. Mm-hmm. And in it, he managed to convince one of his inside sources at NASA, who turns out to have been very highly placed, to come forward and share the photographs of some of the Apollo missions that he was ordered by NASA to destroy. And he did not do so. He kept them in a secret private archive, quite literally, and kept them from destruction. And in fact, I should point out to your listeners that Mr. Hoagland is actually having a conference in Washington, D.C. this coming Tuesday, mm-hmm. where they're going to go over all of this.
Oh, right.
But okay. One of the things that you will see in the book and in these photographs that are being made available for the first time is very clearly in the background of some of the pictures that were taken on the surface of the moon. You can very clearly see enormous, gigantic, crystalline-looking structures sticking up in the horizon. These are not artifacts of photography. These are not tricks of light and shadow. There's just no other way of interpreting them other than artificial structures. Hmm. And the other thing I would point out that Mr. Hoagland has observed on some occasions, and he's written about this on his website, is that the D&M pyramid shows all the signs of having been deliberately targeted by some sort of very powerful directed energy weapon. Mm-hmm. And he also points out that many of the craters on Mars are simply far too shallow to be impact craters. They look more like they are the kinds of things that would result from extremely low burst nuclear weapons in the atmosphere or things of this sort. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, he entertains the idea that maybe these were the results of some war. And I find all this very interesting because one of the things I do in the cosmic war is that I point out that certain geological features on Mars, such as the enormous Valle Marineris, which is this huge, just enormous Grand Canyon-like structure, but it absolutely dwarfs the Grand Canyon for its size and scale.
Yeah.
This is an enormous geological feature on Mars that the best explanation for was that it was created by enormous electrostatic arcing, in other words, by lightning, just literally gouging it out from the surface of the planet.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we couple this idea to the ancient myths of the scarred warrior and so on and so forth, then again, this would seem to be corroborative evidence that this was the result of a deliberate act of destruction. Because that geological feature, if you look at it, I reproduce a photo of it in the book, if you look at it, it's almost straight. You know, lightning in ordinary natural occasions doesn't arc and follow this nice, neat, tidy, straight path. But this does. And there are similar features on the moon where you have evidences of rills that were carved not by lava flows or water or any of this nonsense, but you can clearly see the little pits that are dug out in these rills that are precisely the signatures geologically of enormous electrostatic discharge. So again, we're confronted with something that, if we take the texts seriously about a war, would seem to indicate that they had weapons of extraordinary power and used them.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. And when we're talking about also Hoagland's work here and the NASA space program, this opens up, you know, another can of worms here.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, to begin with, is this idea that I think Hoagland had this up on his website a while back. This was a picture, basically, that NASA released from one of their, basically like a promo poster with the two of their astronauts walking around on Mars.
Right.
Walking up to this hillside and in the front, you know, in the foreground of the picture, just to the right, you could actually see ancient structures that looked kind of, you know, mix, I guess, between some kind of South American, but yet kind of, you know, Persian looking, basically, you know, the structures. Did you see that picture?
I recall vaguely that I did. It's been a while.
And, you know, the question is, why would they do a thing like that, you know?
Well, I think it's to the point now, Henrik, that the evidence that Mr. Hoagland and his associates have compiled and released in the 20-some years that he's been investigating this, I think it's to the point that the preponderance of the evidence and the case that he's been making, particularly now that his new book is out and these new Apollo photos are finally made public.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, I should point out that the man who did this has subsequently been fired from his job at NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California.
Yeah.
So, you know, this to me is the smoking gun. NASA has, I think, now been forced, and probably because of his work over the years, to adopt this policy of gradual release. And I think this is probably what you're seeing with that picture and some of the others that they've released. You know, a few years ago, the idea that NASA would have released the pictures of Iapetus would have been just unheard of. You know, they would have doctored them and then released it.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're not even bothering anymore.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of the fact that he has spent an enormous amount of time and a considerable amount of money in taking some of their previously released and doctored pictures and demonstrating the fact that they have been doctored.
Yeah.
And I think it's the end game as far as NASA's policy of secrecy goes. I don't think that they're going to be able to play quite the same game with him anymore.
Huh, interesting. Another thing, a very, you know, simple idea about the moon, for instance. Why haven't, you know, anyone been back there? I mean, it's been so many years now. What's going on?
Well, I tend to, that's the $64 trillion question, if we allow for inflation. the truly stunning thing to me is that both the United States and the Soviet Union, which clearly had the technology to go there, that in the United States case, we just stopped. And that in the Soviet Union's case, they just sort of gave up inexplicably.
Yeah.
And I can't find any good, plausible explanation for it other than what Hoagland himself has offered, and that is that when we went there on the Apollo missions and certain Luna missions, unmanned probes that the Russians launched, when we got there, we just could not possibly have not seen, those astronauts could not have not seen these enormous structures. And this fact, and the fact that the astronauts who went there seem unable, curiously, to recall any specific details of what they saw there, I think indicates that the missions were simply too dangerous to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
And the classic case that Hoagland cites is the case of Surveyor 4, a little unmanned probe that the United States sent, I think it was in 1965, 66, I don't recall the exact year. But this probe failed, and it failed in a most unusual manner. The telemetry from the probe was functioning perfectly. It had entered its retro rocket burn, it was coming down to a soft landing on the moon, and then all of a sudden it entirely, completely disappeared.
Yeah.
And the reason that Hoagland gives is, you know, if it had exploded or something of that sort, the telemetry data would still have been available to NASA, and we could have seen the process of destruction. But we see nothing. And his explanation is a rather ingenious one. As it's backing down on its retro rockets, it hits one of these structures. And in doing so, the antenna is knocked away, and the beam, the telemetry data, is instantaneously directed away from Earth. In other words, it's still there, but it's missing.
Okay.
And in backing down on one of these structures, it simply self-destructs. And that's why there's no telemetry data. And, you know, this is the most plausible explanation I've found, not only for that probe, but for the fact that we never went back.
Yeah.
The only thing that the United States sent back to the moon, I think, was this little unmanned Clementine probe that the Pentagon, of all people, sent up during the Clinton administration. And then, of course, that disappears mysteriously. So I think that the ultimate reason is that NASA has known all along, and this, I think, is very conclusively demonstrated in his latest book, that there are some sorts of artificial structures on the moon, and that they have wanted to cover this up. And most likely, the Russians have as well. And I think the game is afoot, because now, of course, the European Space Agency, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Indians have all declared that they're making the moon a principal target of their space effort. And, you know, that kind of put the United States on the hot seat.
Yeah, so,
you know, this is the ultimate motivation, I think, for the Bush administration determining that, well, we better go back too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, and that's fascinating, because there is also this idea about the, you know, I think Hoagland actually calls it the other space program, basically. And that, you know, what was his name now? Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian defense minister, mentioned on a TV show that he learned about, you know, ideas, or that this is something that goes or is going around, that they're constructing actually bases on the moon to actually guard against what he called rogue aliens, basically.
Right. This whole idea of the two space programs hypothesis, as you recall from SS Brotherhood of the Bell, is something I think has been there, and I think that Mr. Hoagland would agree with this generalization. I think this two space programs track, if you will, has been there since World War II, because we see the Nazis pursuing conventional rockets. And yet we also see them pursuing a much more secret, much more hidden program to acquire very advanced field propulsion. So, you know, if we factor that into what you're saying here, I think it's definitely the case that there has always been an aspect of at least the American space program, and by extension that would mean logically the Russians as well, and everybody else who has one, that there is some hidden covert technology that's enabling much more extensive exploration of the moon and nearby planetary bodies to occur.
Exactly. Wow, that's you know, that's something to ponder upon. And the idea that they could even be, I mean, I've heard reports of, I can't remember his name now. I think it was actually one astronaut that referred this story, that they encountered something up there that actually, you know, that they basically was warned, NASA, I mean, was warned off the moon and said that, you know, they were not welcome there, you know?
I have heard similar things, and I forget the astronaut's name as well. I think it may have either been Brian O'Leary or perhaps...
I think it was O'Leary. That's probably right.
It may have been someone like that, and... I don't discount that, because the behavior, again, of the United States and the Soviet Union with respect to the moon is just very, very peculiar, and quite frankly, when we get down to the bottom line, it's inexplicable.
Yeah.
And again, I would suspect that the ultimate motivation for America's sudden interest in the moon again isn't really that we ever lost the interest. It's just because now the competition is much more extensive. It's certainly much more sophisticated in terms of the abilities of China or Europe or India or the Japanese to launch technology. I mean, after all, look at the American public program. We're still using the space shuttle.
Yeah.
This is a 30-year-old obsolescent technology.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you know, the Japanese, the Europeans, the Russians have come up with some extraordinarily powerful, very sophisticated boosters. So, you know, this has really, really put the United States, as I said before, in a hot seat as far as space matters go.
Yeah, exactly. And I saw a documentary with one guy from NASA, scientist, who now is working with development of different rockets and so forth. And he basically said in this documentary, I think it was History Channel or Discovery Channel, pretty, you know, mainstream again, that he was basically amazed how they even managed to pull it off with the technology that they had available at the time. Again, implying the idea that there was some kind of split here, that the previous guys actually worked on NASA for some reason, you know, left or they were fired or their knowledge was taken away in some way. And then when these new guys come in, they basically know, you know, nothing.
Well, this is the other thing. At some point, I think NASA suffered tremendously from the loss of the paperclip Germans that we brought over here. Because if we look at the Russian space program, one of the interesting things that the Russians did that we did not do, and it's to the Russians' credit that they saw the dangers implicit in using and relying upon so many German technicians, and they literally had thousands of them that helped jumpstart their space program. But Sergei Korolev, who was really the mastermind, an administrative mastermind, he very quickly decided that he would use these German technicians to train their university students that were studying space matters to take over their role. So in other words, he set up kind of a space internship program very early on in the Russian program. And as a result, the Russians were able to free themselves from this Nazi influence in the mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally repatriated a bunch of these people back to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, we had far fewer of these German engineers. We certainly had the more brilliant ones. But as a result, we were left reliant upon them all throughout the Apollo period. And it's interesting that you mentioned this two-track idea, because I'd like to go back to something I think I may have mentioned in our last interview, and that is the presence of Dr. Kurt Davis as one of the administrators at the Kennedy Space Flight Center in the Apollo program.
Mm-hmm.
Davis was one of the chief scientists involved in the Bell project. In fact, he was the man that designed the power plant for the Bell.
Okay.
And he was also a member of von Braun's rocket team at Peenemünde.
Hmm.
Now, I find this interesting because he is not a rocket scientist at all. His specialty is in high voltage, direct current discharge measurement. That is his specialty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is this man doing as a senior administrator, a flight administrator, actually, for NASA during the Apollo program? Well, my thinking is if we look at the lunar excursion module pictures taking off from the moon, what we do not see, I believe, is the signature of a rocket.
Hmm.
There's certainly a rocket on it. It's certainly firing. You can see this. But
mm-hmm.
It ascends. It just sort of pops off and floats up. Now, a rocket accelerates geometrically. It goes a little further per unit of time. We don't really, in my mind, see that signature. The LEM just immediately accelerates and off it goes. So in other words, I think that we may be looking at an alternative technology, not so much that got us to the moon, but one that got us off the moon. And there is a bit of interesting corroborative evidence, because 2 weeks after the first Apollo moon landing in 1969, Wernher von Braun gave an interview for Time magazine in which he quoted, "The neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon was approximately 43,000 miles from the surface of the Moon."
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you run the numbers out, if you use the 1/6 gravity figure that we've been told that the Moon has,
mm-hmm.
you will end up with a neutral point approximately 23 to 25,000 miles from the surface of the Moon, not 43.
Okay.
In other words, that little figure may indicate that the Moon has a much higher gravity than we have been told publicly.
Mm.
If it has a much higher gravity, then it is unlikely that the rocket that was on the LEM would have been sufficient to get us off the Moon. After all, we required the Saturn V to get us off the Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
So it would have been a much more massive rocket than was actually on that ship. So the only other alternative is some form of alternative technology was in play that we have never been told about. We put all these things together, and again, NASA is dissembling.
Okay. I think I'm onto something here. I mean, rather you're onto it, but the lights,
lights switched on.
Yeah, exactly, precisely. That's right. I mean, okay. And this opens up another can of worms, because considering your research on the Nazis, what they were doing under the war before and even after, we have paperclip and all this, and what you just mentioned with the idea that they actually might have used a rocket here for a kind of a dummy, basically, and they were actually using some other kind of propulsion system here.
Right.
Okay, so could there potentially be here that the Nazis actually was cooperating with someone during the development of their weaponry during World War II, meaning that either they found something, again we go back to potentially some kind of Roswell incident, crashed UFO, something like that, or they were actually in direct contact with another species, ET, could that be a possibility here? That they got the technology from, I mean.
I think it is a possibility, and the reason why is that in the Nazi book previous to SS Brotherhood of the Bell, a book called Reich of the Black Sun, I mentioned the case of Benito Mussolini, who had established a very super secret UFO research group under the direction of none other than Guglielmo Marconi. And I find that extremely, he did this, I think, in 1929, so in other words, it's some number of years prior to the Nazis even taking power.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about this group is, to me, that here we have a clear case, and I reproduce these Italian documents in that book, we have a clear case of a major power that has established a very covert research group to do nothing but study UFOs, and the question is why? And to my way of thinking, once this is done and once Italy enters the Axis Pact, I would not be at all surprised if Mussolini had shared some of this information with the Nazis. I have not found any I've not found any really good, reliable evidence that I can track down or authenticate that any sort of Roswell event occurred either in Italy or inside of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
There are rumors, certainly, that something like that happened. But again, I think if it did happen, given the nature of those two regimes and the ultra-secrecy with which they classified some of their secret projects, that they would have been so deeply classified that it's very unlikely that we would ever know about it. Certainly in the case of the Nazis, it would have immediately gone into the SS and and never really emerged again.
Yeah.
So it's very possible on that view. And there's another way to look at this as well. In the SS Brotherhood, I mention rather extensively, I think it's in the third chapter, about the secret societies that were attempting very deliberately to to channel or get in contact with entities or beings or whatever you prefer to call them via, you know, occult or esoteric means.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been rumored that one of these societies, the so-called Vril Society, on the basis of these attempts or these contacts, attempted to construct or develop some sort of very sophisticated alternative space technology.
Yeah.
And it's intriguing to me, Henrik, because at approximately the same time that this occurs, we have the scientist who later goes on to head the Bell Project, and he's actually a Nobel laureate physicist, very famous physicist by the name of Walter Gerlach.
Mm-hmm.
We have him writing in 1924 in a Frankfurt paper a short little article about stressing mercury and finding out what sort of transmutations may result, and he refers to it as a form of alchemy.
Yeah.
And that's his word, not mine.
Huh.
So you have these little things in play that inside of Germany that indicate that these physicists, you know, someone of Gerlach's stature, my word, these physicists are thinking in terms of the esoteric.
Exactly. And they are also on the hunt for what it seems like both the ancient artifacts and also texts, of course. They're having excursions in Tibet, Egypt, and I wouldn't doubt that they were in Mesopotamia also, you know?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because at the end of the Cosmic War, I actually get back to the Nazi side of things, the Nazi angle, and I point out that as early as 1934, a year into the Nazi regime, Admiral Canaris, who's head of the German Abwehrabteilung, sends agents into Iraq, and they are based, in fact, in Tabriz, in Persia,
mm-hmm.
running these networks inside of Iraq. When Canaris is implicated in the July 44 bomb plot against Hitler, his whole operation is turned over to Himmler. And interestingly enough, Himmler, in turn, places it all under the direction, sit down now, take a big swallow of coffee, places it under the direction of none other than Baron Rudolf von Zeboten-Dorf.
Oh my god.
The light just clicked.
Yep.
Of course, because Zeboten-Dorf was one of the chief movers in the founding of the Thule Gesellschaft,
yeah.
was the secret occult society that midwifed the Nazis into existence in the first place.
Yeah.
So in other words, the signs are all there that the Nazis are snooping around in Mesopotamia for something,
huh.
and it's got to have some sort of esoteric significance for people like Himmler and Zeboten-Dorf to be interested and involved in it.
Exactly. Wow, my God.
Yeah, wow.
Sheesh. Yeah, talking about the pieces coming together here.
Oh, yes.
Wow. And again, we have the idea here, going back to why this is even interesting, you know, in context to what is happening today, because this, again, is going back to the idea that many of these Nazis, the ideas, the, you know, philosophies behind this was, you know, transmuted, I guess we could say, into the Americans and some to the Soviet side. And this, to some degree, is continuing to this day, I would imagine.
Oh, yes, absolutely, I think so. Absolutely, I think so. Because, again, you know, we have to go back to the fact that when NASA was formed by President Eisenhower, most of the premier engineers inside of NASA were, in fact, German. They were, in fact, members of the SS.
Mm.
We go further back into Paperclip, and we have the entire German military intelligence on the Eastern Front taken over lock, stock, and Nazi by Alan Dulles and rolled into the operational desk of what would become the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
So these influences in American institutions are palpable and pervasive and quite influential.
Yeah, there's a totally different agenda going on here. And again, when you're looking behind the scenes, there is no enemy anymore, because they are either fighting another enemy or trying to, you know, figure something completely different out behind the scenes. And in a way, we are given these, you know, ideas that there is tremendous fighting going on between these, you know, states and so forth. But there is a much more, you know, occult agenda behind it all, you know?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I believe so, absolutely.
Hmm. Yeah. I also wanted to run this by you, and that was why I was so excited that you brought, you know, in the Nazis into this and tied it together here, because with the technology and all this that we talked about, that potentially they could have gotten this technology from someone else or so forth. But there are abduction reports that has come out that the Nazis has been, I think this go back to the Betty and Barney Hill case, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yes.
Nazis and actually Grey, basically, as we know as the Greys, have been seen together. Do you have any more, information about this? Have you researched this at all?
Well, I haven't researched the abduction phenomenon at all in any depth to be able to see a pattern like that emerge. However, you mentioned Betty and Barney Hill, and again, I go back to a very interesting thing that Barney Hill said to his psychiatrist when he was under hypnosis. His psychiatrist asked him, what did these people look like? And Barney Hill's response was, they look like Nazis.
Huh.
And those are his words.
Yeah.
Now, I find that very interesting because here you have, in the whole Hill abduction episode, a very clear case that something of an extraterrestrial nature occurred, because you have, after all, Betty Hill's star map, which was successfully reconstructed by Marjorie Fish and aligned with known celestial bodies. So, you know, you have someone, a lady who's not even familiar with astronomy, able to do this. So there is an extraterrestrial connection. It's there and it's palpable.
Yeah.
But sitting, or so to speak, squatting right in the middle of it, you have this very strange reference from Barney Hill to Nazis.
Yeah.
And it strikes you as so very odd and very peculiar. But if both are true, then what you're saying about a possible pattern in other abduction cases would certainly ring true, because it's there in the most famous abduction case of them all.
Exactly. Yeah, this opens up questions and make you think of you know, what some of the connections are here, and even we could even again tie in the fact of time travel or something like that this actually are officers from the early or late World War that actually are traveling into the future. You know, who knows what the heck is going on
here? Who knows? Exactly. Who knows? Who knows? But whatever it is, it's going on very secretly.
Exactly. That's right. I want to return just a little bit before we round things off here for this segment and talk a little bit more about why we, you know, potentially haven't been back then to the moon, and just wanted to run this idea by you. I have heard that there was some kind of treaty involved between the human race and whatever alien race that actually had these bases on the moon and probably elsewhere. Kind of a treaty or some kind of, basically this was something that they basically put a lid on us or the planet, so to speak, and we were not supposed to go off planet before a certain date. And interestingly enough, in this idea expressed that the date that came up was actually 2012. and we were actually only about 5 years away from this date. And what is interesting is that, just that you mentioned before, that China, Japan, Russia, and I think even the U.S. is going to be involved some way in this now, is sending, you know, more probes and stuff up to the moon to kind of, check out the territory basically up there, because potentially if this idea or what I've heard is true to some extent, this would mean that After 2012, we would be allowed again to go off planet, or at least, you know, visit the moon. And now they're basically, you know, checking out the neighborhood up there again to actually see what, you know, what potentially could be a good real estate up there. I don't know. What's your idea on that?
Well, I haven't heard of this. However, it does fit the timetables that these various powers have announced for their moon projects. It dovetails rather nicely, I think, with what the Chinese have announced that they want to do, and for that matter, the Japanese. I would suspect that it's going to reflect basically the uptime that's needed to get some of these missions accomplished. But again, it fits very neatly into it, so I can't dismiss it.
Yeah. Hmm. Very interesting. One final thing here. We talked about earlier about Star Wars. Have you looked at Frank Herbert's Dune at all?
I am familiar with it. I haven't looked at it as nearly as extensively as I have Star Wars.
Hmm. Yeah, that's because one idea again is just what briefly talked about these houses basically fighting each other. But again, this is a recurring theme in a lot of these science fiction stories. We have, for instance, going back to again the Nazis and the connection between the Greys and abductions. We can even look at the most recent series that Spielberg released called Taken. Did you ever see that?
Steven Spielberg series, yeah, I did see that about four years ago now, I think about it.
Yeah.
So I think it's all, you know, just to kind of follow up the Star Wars idea with Dune and some of these other things, I think it is a kind of a carefully calculated, controlled release of information. I really do. I can't see any other way to look at it, because if we look at all the coincidences that these movies have with some of these ancient myths, the more coincidences we pile up, the less coincidental they are.
That's right. Do you think it is about acclimatization, or is it about indoctrination of these ideas?
I think a little bit of both, to be honest.
That's interesting. You know, Joseph, I think this is a great place to round things off. And
sure.
I want to thank you for, you know, one of the most exciting interviews we've done here for a long time. It's fascinating to have you on. And again, I would love to have you back at some point again and continue discussing, because there's
Sure, my pleasure. I enjoy being on.
Thank you. And I want to leave the floor open, as it were. We've talked about many books, in this last segment, our subscriber interview. Mention the one that, you have SS Brotherhood of the Bell, you have Giza Death Star, and go ahead and mention those you have and how people would get them for those who are interested in finding out much more about this.
There's six books right now. There's the Giza Death Star, the Giza Death Star Deployed, and the Giza Death Star Destroyed. There are two books on Nazi secret weapons, Reich of the Black Sun and the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And then the new book, The Cosmic War, Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics, and Ancient Texts. All the books are $16.95 American dollars each. The Cosmic War is, however, $18.95, and they can reach the publisher at 1-800-718-4514. Or online at www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com, and all the books are 10% off if you order three or more, and they can also get them, of course, on Amazon.com.
Excellent. adventuresunlimitedpress.com, and also don't forget to check out Joseph's website. It's GizaDeathStar.com. Joseph, a true pleasure having you back on. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Henrik. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.